First case in our calendar is 9/7/16/26, Jeff Chamberlain et al. Versus AK Steel. Mr. Horn.
Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Watch your time.
Okay, please report my name to Dave Horn. I'm here on behalf of the company AK Steel. Steel is the company that we use to John Chris, General Counsel, President of AK Steel. Steel, my wife, is Paul Margo, which is named after the name of the company. We're here today to talk about the Power Revised Code, Section 2505.02. And the issue of whether an order granting class certification is appealable under that statute. As the court, I believe, knows, that statute was recently amended. Unfortunately, those amendments occurred after the case had been fully briefed, so the parties did not have the opportunity to brief the impact of those amendments on the issue in this case. Therefore, what I would like to do today, although I obviously would be happy to answer any questions you have about any issues, I intend to focus my remarks on the impact of those amendments on these issues. Those amendments are relevant to the issues in this case in two respects. First, if this court renders its decision after July 21st, 1998, which is the effective date of those amendments, then the court must apply the law as it is set forth in those amendments.
Why?
Your Honor, both sides of this case have agreed that it is the general rule of appellate practice that an appellate court should apply the law in effect at the time it renders its decision. The appellees cited a case for that principle in their memorandum in opposition to our motion for leave to file supplemental briefs. We concur with that. It's an Ohio Supreme Court decision. There are a variety of decisions that have so held. And that's why you should apply that law.
Regardless of whether or not it's procedural or substantive?
Your Honor, the issue I think you're addressing is has to do with retroactivity. The law, in effect, should apply. If it is retroactive, then you could apply to pending litigation. If it's not retroactive, then you would not. In this particular instance, it is retroactive.
It almost sounds like you're willing to concede that as of today, the case law is pretty strong that says it's not a final appealable order.
No, Your Honor, I don't agree with that at all. I believe that it is a final appealable order, even under the current statute. We have briefed those issues. My point in addressing the amendments is that we have not had the opportunity to brief those, and I want to try to argue as best I can the issues related to that. I do not believe at all that what you suggest is correct.
Well, why do you have to even talk about the amendment? It should be your position, and I think it is, with the motion that we received, that it's absolutely clear under the amended statute that this is now a final appealable order. So why do we need any argument about that? The only issue is whether or not it's a final appealable order now.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, although there are parties, even under the amended statute, which remain open, that I think this court can address. Those issues are, what does it mean when you say that an order is made in a special proceeding? And certainly the language you're referring to is Section D5 of the statute is clear.
Mm-hmm.
But you still have that issue of what does it mean when a statute when an order is made in a special proceeding under the new amendments. In addition, you also have the issue of what does it mean when you say that an order in effect determines an action. This court has the opportunity, even under the new amendment, to try to clarify those ambiguities of the law. In fact, if this court were to interpret the new statute and clarify those ambiguities, it would go a long way towards clearing up what has been a very unstable and unclear area of the law, because those are, I believe, the remaining two issues that need to be determined.
Is there any statute that provides for class actions?
Yes, there are statutes that do, not a general statute, there are particular statutes that do apply to class actions, Your Honor, yes.
Okay, and did we know about these at common law class actions?
There were class actions of certain types recognized in common law. Opt-out class actions were not.
Don't we just get to class actions pursuant to the civil rules? And wouldn't then that fall under Polakoff and some of the other cases?
And
because we very clearly said in the Dayton abortion clinic case that it's not a final appealable order when there's a granting or there's a denial of a class action suit. Didn't we say that as clear as it could be, and then maybe in Moskowitz too?
Your Honor, I think that gets to the issue of what do you mean when words made in a special proceeding. In this particular instance, I believe the focus should not be whether it's a class action, it's just a procedural device. Rather, it should be on the substantive causes of action that are included in the case below. For example, if this action were only a declaratory judgment action, then under the law established by this court, it would be determined to be a special proceeding. The same would be true for a wrongful death action. The same would be true for a statutory employment intentional tort action. What we have here is an action which combines those causes of action, which are special proceedings, with another type of common law cause of action. And so the question becomes, when is an order made in a special proceeding under those circumstances? I don't believe the relevant determination should be whether it's a class action. It should be whether or not, because of the presence of those actions which are special proceedings, the entire action should be treated as one.
Well, almost in every complaint you can file, find separate causes of action that you can argue. The issue is whether or not the order is appealable, not whether a particular clause in the complaint is.
Well, Your Honor, you have to look at what the order applies to. And I believe in this case that the order impacts all of those causes of action to be a special proceeding. What the issue this court needs to decide, and that is still an ambiguity in the law, even under the amendments, is what do you mean when you say an order was made in a special proceeding? I understand your point that the order is one affecting class certification, but this court held, as you suggested, that you don't focus on the order, you focus on the underlying action itself. In this case, the underlying action itself, although it's a class action as a procedural device, includes causes of action that would be a special proceeding. And so the issue this court
I thought that underlying action was certainly explained well in Walters, what it means. And you're still adhering to this interpretation that we're talking about the cause of action.
Your Honor, I believe Walters explains very well that the focus is on the underlying action.
What is before us? In this instance, the class certification.
In this instance, Your Honor, there is an underlying action that contains three causes of action, which if brought alone would constitute special proceedings. So the question is, under the law of Ohio,
we do not agree on what underlying action means.
I would just respectfully disagree on that, Your Honor.
Earlier you were mentioning the amendments to 250502. When you look at them, special proceeding defined, it appears it follows Holocaust exactly.
If we need to do it by
entry
to go to Dr. Forsher, I fetch his petition.
Absolutely.
Thank you. At least we agree on that.
Yes, sir.
Isn't there some difficulty in that argument with the fact that your appeal doesn't really affect the underlying action, does it? You're not asking the court, you didn't ask the court of appeals in this appeal to do anything about the underlying action. The challenge was to the trial court's judgment that this should be a class action.
It does impact the underlying action, Your Honor, because each of those causes of action will apply will be brought on behalf of either the named plaintiff only or the entire class. Therefore, the court's decision has a direct impact on those different causes of action.
But not on the merits.
It does affect the merits of the cause of action, I agree with that, Your Honor. But if, for example, the action were brought only as a statutory employment intentional tort case, and the issue was should that case be certified as a class, and we sought to appeal that decision, I believe under Walters it would clearly be an appealable decision because that would be a statutory proceeding, a special proceeding. So the question is, why should it not be an appealable order simply because it has been joined with a common law cause of action? That would be the question this court needs to address, I believe, even under the amended statute, although we do believe very strongly, as I suggested, that if this court renders its decision after July 21st, it should interpret the statute as amended. Even if this court issues its decision before July 21st, the date when the amendments become effective, the court should still give consideration and interpret the statute as announcing in accordance with the amendment. The reason for that is the general principle of appellate review, that when a statute has been ambiguous, subsequent legislation amending that statute is relevant to determining what was the legislative intent of the prior statute. A week ago, we filed a list of additional authorities which stand for that proposition, and I'd be happy to go through them again, but I believe you already have. Each of those cases includes a statement by a particular court of the relevant case law in that regard. Let me just read one of them to you, just to get a flavor of what I'm talking about. This is from Morty Pleasant, Hassler Construction Company, Arizona Supreme Court decision. It is a rule of statutory construction that where in the enactment of a law, the legislature employs in a subsequent clause of the same act or in later legislation on the same subject, language clarifying a doubtful expression, therefore used, the court should give that language the meaning the legislature intended. Each of the six cases we cited, including Supreme Court decisions, and one, I admit, very old decision by this court, stand for the same proposition. So even if this court is going to interpret the statute as it currently stands, it should do so consistent with the legislative intent as expressed in the amendments to the statute that will go into effect July 21st. I think the other issue the court needs to address is what does it mean when we say that a order in effect determines an action. This court has never addressed that issue in the context of a class certification. And I believe that this case gives it the opportunity to do so. And as I said, again, that's an open issue which the lower courts have struggled with. And I think this court could clarify and add, Justice Douglas, in your words, in the Dayton case, add some stability and clarity to the law in this area. If I clear enough those open issues.
Let's talk about that, determines the action. If a class is certified or not, does that not only determine who are the plaintiffs in the action?
Your Honor, if the class is certified, we have cited numerous articles and empirical evidence suggesting it will have the practical effect of determining the action, because rarely do the cases that are certified as classes go to trial.
I understand, but then, so what, and that's the argument that you put forth in your brief, that really it's this practically speaking, folks will be required to settle, and, you know, there's the monetary and the expense that goes with having a class certified, but, I mean, in the law, the term determining the action has never been determining the practical effect to the defendant, has it?
No, Your Honor, but the language of the statute is not determining the action. The language of the statute is, in effect, determining the action.
Mm-hmm.
The court must give meaning to those words, in effect.
Okay.
It didn't say, actually determine the action.
Boy, that would be something.
In effect,
we said, in effect, determine the action. Anytime we tilt the balance in favor of, you know, that some activity on the part of the court would seem to favor one side or the other. The admission of a certain exhibit, you know, you could have pretrial rulings on motions in limine, for instance. Could those, in effect, you know, if you thought that this was the key witness or the key document, could that arguably, like this, determine the action?
I think that probably goes too far, Your Honor. No, I don't believe that would, but I think under these circumstances, under all of the evidence that a variety of other courts have recognized the impact of certification, I think there it does in effect do that. Indeed, this court itself, in the Amada decision, so held. I recognize under different standards it's been reversed, but the determination of this court with regard to the impact of class certification has not been reversed.
Let's go back and talk about your statutory argument a minute, your amendment article argument. On January 1 of a given year, you loan me $1,000. We enter into a note, 10% interest. In 6 months, it's due and payable. March, the General Assembly passes a statute that says any transaction between the parties, private transaction like this, can carry no greater than 5% interest. In June, you come to collect your money from me. You want 10% or 5%?
Your Honor, there are circumstances that the answer to your question is determined based on whether the statute is remedial or substantive in nature. I suspect that what you've described would be substantive, so your answer it would be whatever the law was at the time we entered into the note.
Okay, so you're at least willing to concede on the substantive issue that the law in effect at the time of the transaction is what should govern.
Substantive law, yes.
Okay, now don't you think probably to some of these people that are trying to be cut out here that it's pretty substantive to them?
Your Honor, this court has held on a variety of occasions that appeals are remedial in nature. And the test for whether that retroactivity is effective was set out by this court in the Van Fossen case. And it's a two-part test. Did the legislature state clearly its intent to be retroactive? And clearly the legislature has done so here. And the second part of the test is remedial in nature. And this court has held repeatedly that an appeal is remedial in nature. And so I believe that under the law, if this court has set it out, that retroactivity is enforceable. Your Honor, I believe my time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. Mr. DeMarco.
Your Honors, the rule of decision in this case is supplied by Volokhov-Silvas. Volokhov-Silvas says that orders entered in actions that were recognized in common law or in equity and were not specially created by legislation are not orders in special proceedings. That applies.
If you take that principle, why are we in a granted classification by the rule?
Because those are appealable under a different prong of 25.05.02. Those are appealable under the prong that says that the order has determined the action and prevents the judgment. In this case, this court in Romish held that when a court denies class certification, the court, as a matter of law, I use the term sui juris, as a matter of law.
We were attacking in some cases on a and now you're saying it is a special proceeding for appealable orders for class granted, but it's not a special proceeding for class denied?
No. Under Romish, an order that denies class certification is appealable, having nothing to do with special proceedings. It is appealable because this court has held it determines the action for the members of the absent members of the class. This court has held in Romish that it cuts off their rights as a matter of legal effect. And to address the questions that Justice Cook was raising, Mr. Horn's argument is that the court should find that granting a class certification affects or determines the action as a matter of practical effect. And I think the examples that Justice Cook used show that goes too far. As a matter of practical effect, there are many things that discourage parties in an action, but they don't determine the action and they don't preclude the party from getting a judgment.
Doesn't it strike you as something terribly unfair that if you grant class, you can appeal it, but if you deny class, enormous ramifications can be handled? Isn't there something inherently unfair
there? Your Honor, this court has held in Volokhov and the other cases that 25.05.02 is to be determined based on the way it's written, not based on policy arguments. And I do not consider it unfair for the court to read 25.05.02 as it's written. I think that is what all of us expect the court to do. And 25.05.02 is written as defining special proceedings. And under Volokhov, this is not a special proceeding because it wasn't, as Justice Douglas has pointed out, and as he pointed out at the Dayton Women's Center, it wasn't created by, class actions weren't created by special legislation. They existed common law. So the way the statute is written, it's not a special proceeding. The way the statute is written, an order that denies class certification prevents a judgment. This court has so held, and all we're asking the court to do is to stand by its precedent.
Don't we have a similar situation with summary judgments? The denial of a summary judgment is appealable. The granting of some version is appealable, right. Denial is not.
Exactly. There are many things that can discourage parties throughout the course of litigation going forward. But obviously the granting of the summary judgment has an immediate legal effect on the party's rights and precludes the judgment. Those are the words of 25.2. There isn't the same legal effect when a motion for summary judgment is denied. All that's saying is the case is going on. All it's saying in the class action context when the class certification is granted is this case is going on to final judgment. And that's what 25.05.02, the determination of the action prompt, means. So Polakoff supplies the rule of decision in the case, and as I understood Mr. Horn's argument, it's a fairly simple application. Just look at the underlying action. He disagreed with Justice Resnick on what the underlying action means. I think this court has gone through great pains in Walters and in Polakoff to explain what it means by underlying action. Keep in mind what the court said in conclusion in Walters, said the underlying action is a civil action seeking damages. In this case, it's a civil action seeking damages too. In fact, I heard Mr. Horn talk about how important all of those other factors were in the trial court's decision. He mentioned the declaratory relief and all that. Significant because if you review his memorandum in opposition to class certification, he said that this case, the primary relief sought in this case, was money damages. And throughout his entire brief in opposition to class certification, he did not once mention declaratory relief. I think this is a case where we see the danger of his argument from his argument. We see that if you allow one cause of action or one minuscule allegation in a complaint to allow a party to recharacterize it and recast it as a special proceeding, parties will do that. Parties will do that. They will contrive to do that. And I'm not just saying defendants, I'm saying plaintiffs will do it too.
What if we, and follow me through with this, because I think this is talking about the fairness issue that was raised. What if we say, yeah, this case is a final appealable order, and we affirm the granting of a class? Goes back to the trial court for a class action suit. In the middle of the trial judge finds, wait a minute, there's no commonality of interest. The parties are different. These cases all have to be approved separately. Could the trial court then, in effect, decertify the class or just say, I had an interlocutory order and therefore this class should not have been granted?
Every class certification, Your Honor,
is subject to that.
Yes, Justice Resnick pointed that out, and I believe you did also, I think it was Dayton Women's Center.
It was.
These class certification orders, in Justice Resnick's words, can't prevent a judgment because in themselves they are not final. They're always modifiable. They're always...
Always through the whole trial process, the court could do a number of things. Could say, okay, I made a mistake. Shouldn't be a class action. It could create subclasses. It could amend the class, the basic, the underlying class. But my question was, what if we say, yes, it is a final appealable order, affirm the judgment of the trial court, and then the class action and the class certification is over forever, isn't it?
If you affirm the class certification order, it seems to me that the class certification becomes the law. It's over forever, yes.
Is that the effect of the new statute also? The statute makes it clear that these are the appeal orders.
The new statute, Your Honor, speaks in terms of orders granting and denying class certification. I accept that. What Mr. Horn has argued is that this court ought to look at the new statute and apply it. Well, first of all, as this court knows, under Article 2, Section 1C, this court cannot constitutionally apply that new statute until it's in effect, and it won't be in effect until July 21st. He then fell back to, well, you should give it consideration interpreting the new statute. Well, that's the same thing. That was also inimical to Article 2, Section 1C. I submit it's also inimical to the concept of separation of powers. Mr. testified after he had filed his briefs in this case, he testified before the legislature, and he said that orders that grant class certification are not currently appealable, even though he had told the court just the opposite. I assume, I don't know, but I assume when he testified before the legislature, he also told them that he had a case pending before this court. Well, that didn't stop the legislature from enacting the amendment to 2505.02. I submit that's consistent with separation of powers. Since the legislature did not forego from legislating in this area, this court should not withhold its decision or should not anticipate what the law will be. This court's obligation is to apply the law as it exists now.
Now, today? What day? What day? Should it be the day of the argument?
Well,
or the day of the decision? You know, it's sort of interesting to think about. If the decision weren't out, what is that rule?
It's interesting to think about, but I think it's a fairly simple concept of, is the case ripe for decision? And it is ripe for decision today. So if the court decides the case based on its normal decision-making process, it applies the law as it is when it hears the case. That's today. Actually waiting until the new statute takes effect, I think, is something that this court hasn't done before and would be inimical to the concept of separation of powers, just because these are four different branches of government, judiciary and legislature, doesn't mean that their activities ought to be coordinated. So in answer to your question, I think it's what is in effect when the case is ripe for decision, which is today. The Arizona case that Mr. Horn referred to talks about, it's a very old case, it talks about how a statute ought to be used in clearing up a doubtful expression. But I didn't hear Mr. Horn explain what about Polakoff is in doubt. The syllabus in Polakoff was clarified in Walters, so that's no longer in doubt. That question isn't the order, is the action. What does Mr. Horn believe is in doubt? The underlying action, I think, here is very clearly a class action. And as they admitted in their opposition to class certification.
Well, counsel, the plaintiff doesn't have a claim for a class action. When you say this is the underlying claim here is a class action.
That's right.
Isn't that just, I just asked that of counsel for the other side, that in terms of deciding whether class action certification does or does not decide the action.
Right.
If you say that the action itself is a class action, that is the claim the plaintiffs have?
No, that's not the claim that the plaintiffs have, but keep in mind the words that both Polakoff and Walters used over and over, the underlying action. They do not use the term underlying cause of action. And also keep in mind
But if you're distinguishing as between order and action, the distinction was made that it isn't the order being made, it's the underlying action.
The underlying action.
What do you think that word means, then?
I think it means in this situation, class action, because of what the court said in Polakoff. Keep in mind, in Polakoff, it was a shareholder derivative suit. Polakoff never even talked about what the underlying claims were, what the basis of the claims were. It said, this is a shareholder's derivative suit. Significantly, shareholder's derivative suits and class actions are both representative forms of action, but they are forms of actions that exist under the civil rules. They weren't created by any special legislation, as Justice Douglas pointed out. They came into existence 21.23 and Rule 23.1 because the legislature didn't. So I think to be consistent with Polakoff and his analysis of the shareholder's derivative suit there, I think you have to look at the form of action here, which is a class action, an analogous form of representative action, and say that's the underlying action that the court was talking about in Walters and in Polakoff. It is, moreover, an underlying action that the defendants concede seeks damages. That's the second prong of Polakoff, where you take a look at the relief sought. They acknowledge this is a case that seeks damages. So under Walters, we also have a civil action seeking damages, same as in Walters, and that should be the end of Polakoff analysis. Your Honor, the only other point that was made, I think, was in regard to the determination of the action, and I think in addressing Justice Stratton's questions, the way that the court should analyze it is what is the legal effect of the order, the legal effect of an order that grants class certification is not comparable in any respect to the order denying class certification. There is no legal effect of cutting off the absent class members' rights or the defendant's rights when a class action certification is granted. There is the legal effect of cutting off the absent class members' rights when a class certification is denied. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. DeMarco. Mr. Horne, you've used your time, so may take 30 seconds.
Counsel, I'm interested in your suggestion that we apply the new statute, which, as Justice Cook indicated, raises an interesting cross-sex issue for us. We hear the case today. Typically, we decide the case is heard the same day.
Idea what the mess they created right. With that statute, making every class action appeal.
So, ordinarily, the item wouldn't be completed in this case until sometime after the effective date of the statute.
They made it appeal.
What you were supposed to do would affect
see
one of the other things that we do over time. So what should we do? So, not just for this case, but for others, we should rewrite, reconsider cases as effective new statutes become effective.
No, if a case has already been issued, I'm not suggesting you rewrite. I'm saying my case is pending. You apply
what if, for example, the General Assembly on an emergency basis passes a piece of legislation that takes
effect from the governor. That's right.
After a case is argued, but before opinion is issued,
yes.
Would you consider that?
If, in fact, the law is effective before this court's decision is rendered, I would say yes, sir. Maybe you appropriately ask the parties to rebrief it, but I would say yes, you should apply the law.
And would it be the responsibility of the parties then to make us aware of those kinds of occurrences?
I would believe so, yes, Sean. If the party believes that the new legislation is going to impact this case, I would say yes, to make you aware of it. Your Honor, I believe not only should this court wait, the law is what I believe I just described. It is the time the court renders its decision. The case that both parties are relied upon in that regard is Gulf Offshore Company versus Mobil Oil Corporation, 1981 case by the U.S. Supreme Court, 453 U.S. 473. There are a number of other cases that have also held that proposition that I were just discussing. But I believe it's also important that this court do that, because if it doesn't do that, it's going to further add confusion. Since 1993, this court has reversed itself on issues under Section 2505.02 five different times. Justice Douglas, you made reference to the fact that it's added rampant confusion in this area of the law. I understand there's been good reason for this court to do that. I'm not suggesting the decisions are inappropriate. I'm simply suggesting that it is causing confusion and instability. If this court does, for the
plaintiff's asks, which is to rule before the new statute becomes effective. This court's decision is going to be legislatively overturned by the new statute, and it's going to further cause confusion.
But that's not unusual. I mean, the legislature has the authority to overrule decisions that we make whenever they want to. That's unusual, isn't it?
My point is, though, that it is an area of the law that is already confusing because of the reversals, and that would further add to the confusion. This court has the opportunity to stop that confusion by using the new statute as an opportunity for a fresh start, where it clarifies the ambiguities and gets rid of all of the past cases where there has been confusion because of reversals.
Well, I'm interested in this because I'm sensitive to your point, but it seems to me that if we were to affirm in this case, that's the law in this case, but as of July 21st, it's no longer the law for any other case. Isn't that the situation, or am I missing something?
Well, I believe it would be the case insofar as the narrow issue in this case is no longer in effect. Yeah, the statute, that's correct, and it could well be the case with regard just to the issue of grants of class certification. There could be other issues that's worth addressing that wouldn't serve the law.
Thank you, Mr. Horn. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.